Stone Circle is back in June 2024. Forget your Glastonbury's and your Coachella's. This is the Midsummer Festival every gravel rider needs on their calendar. With three awesome routes, 55k, 155k and 220k's, there really is something for everyone. There's also a campsite with showers, hot food, cold beer, an optional fancy dress hill climb and lots of other fun stuff to make it the best weekend of 2024. Prices from £55, book Stone Circle today at hotchili.com and get a fiver off with the code PODCAST5. Hot Chili is spelled H-O-T-C-H-I-L-L-E and .com is spelled full stop C-O-M. Welcome to Sigma Sports Presents Matt Stevens Unplugged, and we have a very special episode today as I'm joined by Pippa York to chat about her BYOC policy, that's bring your own chainring, whether eggs belong in soup, and how she's taking Pride Month online. The Grand Chores is back, and this week I'm making the bed. Stay tuned because you don't want to miss that. Hello and welcome. Are you ready?
Because it's that time again. Matt Stevens Unplugged by Sigma Sports.
Proven to save between 2 and 5 watts, the combination of Ceramic Speed's OSPW system and UFO chain make for one of the fastest drivetrains on the market. Throughout June, order an OSPW system at Sigma Sports and get a free UFO chain. There's never been a better time to upgrade to ultimate performance. Find out more about this offer on the podcast page at sigmasports.com. Philippa York is one of the most successful British riders of her era, and her Palmares competing as Robert Miller are hugely impressive. Top results include the polka dot jersey at the 1984 Tour de France and narrowly missing out on the GC at the Vuelta a España in 1985, which many consider to have been stolen from her controversially. I know Pippa very well, and it was an absolute pleasure to catch up with her recently, even if she didn't know what frazzles were.
Well, that's a shame. I was enjoying Paw Patrol.
Yeah. Have you ever watched Paw Patrol?
No, but I'm just going to look it up now.
It's something. It's pretty sensational. Apparently, before you came on, Niall was saying that they've each series gets even more bizarre, and now they've all got jetpacks. But right. they're a group of animals who inhabit this town, but they all work for the emergency services, so like fire brigade, ambulance, police officers, stuff like that. So, you know,
yeah, I'm just in there now.
I do love the internet. It's great, isn't it? And it's brilliant though. We're here on a podcast in lockdown. We had a kid on the line earlier, Niall, the producer, and now Pippa York is looking up Paw Patrol, and it's going to enhance your life for the better, I think.
And now I know what Paw Patrol is.
Apparently, it's a big deal. Apparently, when you see kids walking around with little backpacks and packed lunch boxes. It is a bit of a big deal. So there you go. We've both learned something. Well, you have...
Six brave puppies and a tech-savvy 10-year-old boy called Ryder.
Well, Pippa, welcome to Matt Stevens Unplugged. Thanks very much for joining us. It's an absolute pleasure because this is the first time we've kind of... Well, we did a thing a couple of years ago, didn't we? But this is the first time we've ever done a podcast together.
Yes. And,
It is a pleasure, but for the benefit of our audience, could you just tell us where you are in the world and what is immediately surrounding you, so people can really set the scene?
So I live in a little village in Dorset, and when I look out the window, I can see greenery and trees, and it's right next door to the Sustrans cycle route number 2. And when I look out the back window, I can't see anything beyond the pear tree, which is as thick as an afro hairstyle almost. Is that crazy?
Right.
So I see countryside when I look out the windows mostly.
Very, very nice. It's beautiful Dorset though, isn't it? It's a lovely, lovely part of the world. I guess, because I've spoken to you before about it, it's quite a sleepy little place, isn't it?
Yes, that's why I live here.
Yeah, nice and quiet.
That's exactly why I live here. There's something like, I think, what is it, 350,000 people in the whole of Dorset. So there's, outside of the two main towns, which are Bournemouth and Poole, which are all just basically one town, really.
Yeah.
So 350,000 people is, what, a small town near London. So there's not that many people. It's quite sleepy, like you say.
Very, very nice. Now, how, first off the bat, how is lockdown been treating you, or have you kind of, I mean, what's your kind of state of mind at the moment?
Probably I'm a bit bored. At first it was weird because when you went outside there was nobody in the streets.
Yeah.
So it was like being a 1960s zombie movie. Yes. Nobody about.
Yeah.
And then when I started going cycling, because obviously I've got nothing to do, it's like going training and going riding in Scotland where there's nobody about and you could ride for half an hour before you saw a car.
Yeah.
But now I've kind of got used to it and there's more people about. So, it's a bit of a shame that people have reappeared on the streets and on the roads.
It's a funny cat. Oh, what's the cat called? Wow, that's pretty
that's
loud.
That's authentic.
Definitely. I mean, it's interesting, a moment ago you said you live near one of the Susterns trails, and I know when we spoke up, you know, a couple of years ago, you weren't really riding a bike that much, but it appears that you, and I know you've hopped on Zwift recently, different kind of bike racing entirely, and we do follow each other on Zwift. Are you enjoying getting back into riding? How are you kind of finding it?
I did stop for 2 and a bit years.
That's cool. Yeah.
Quite a lot. So I've had to re-establish what my kind of baseline level of speed and fitness is.
Yeah.
According to my age and gender and all the rest of it.
Sure.
I don't go very far and I don't feel that I go very fast. So when people pass me, which they do nowadays, I'm not that bothered about it. I don't go training. I go out for a ride, which is a different kind of mindset than it was when I was racing. So I just kind of, I don't bumble along. I try to go a decent speed so I don't feel like I'm struggling. But now and again, I do struggle. That's okay. I've got used to that now.
Yeah.
And so I probably, before Zwift, which is another story altogether, I'd probably ride 3 times a week. And before lockdown, and that would be an hour and a half maximum.
Right.
But with the roads so empty, and I can go on roads which I wouldn't have went on before to go places which I didn't go to before, I've been going 2 hours, 2.5 hours, which is a long way for me. So then I have to take food because I don't have the reserves to ride. I don't have the same capacities to ride that far without food. So then I have to take food. So that's kind of changed everything. And I have to stop and get water and stuff like that. So it's a bit different. It's not training. It's definitely not training. It's just riding along.
No, I was just saying, I still train a bit, but I also ride my bike. And as I said, they're quite a different thing. And I get overtaken. And when I was a reasonable bike rider, getting overtaken was didn't really happen very often, I guess. And you take umbrage and you just attack them and you'd go back over the top. But now it's quite a liberating feeling knowing you're just riding your bike and enjoying it and soaking in the atmosphere rather than feeling perpetual pain, because most training rides really are remarkably uncomfortable, aren't they? But just riding your bike now, for me, I actually enjoy riding, you know, more than I ever have, because I can turn it on if I want to go a bit hard, but generally I just bumble around, you know, and I find it really pleasurable.
Well, before you could choose when you started hurting. So it's the speed of the terrain which you went over things or along things at which hurt you. It wasn't the basic kind of topography that did that. But nowadays, for me anyway, hills hurt, so I go slower. So they don't hurt. And then I've discovered that you need all the gears on your bike.
Exactly.
Because otherwise it hurts. And that wouldn't have been the case before. I would have looked at a hill and thought, I'll use that gear, and I'd ride up at that on a certain gear and probably not bother changing it if it got too big and just cope with that level of pain. Well, nowadays I don't want that level of pain. So then I use all the gears. If people catch me, I don't really care. If I catch other people, I don't really care.
It's funny. There's people get seemed. I mean, I'm just looking at Twitter sometimes and I probably get too immersed in it. I don't normally interact that much, but seeing people getting very, very angry about being caught and overtaken and the abuse people get, especially women who might overtake a bloke and then the bloke overtakes them and sort of starts calling them out. I mean, it's a really weird, strange kind of psychology, and I'm bemused by it. I mean, it's very, very strange. I mean, just actually one thing that I wanted to ask you, back when you were competing as Robert Miller, we're talking about gears on climbs now. When you were, because I was posting the other week, posted a little picture of me riding the Giro, and on, and I think our lowest gears we had then were 39.25. But back in the 80s, what ratios were you using in a Grand Tour? I'm just fascinated because the gearing we've got now is, you can have like 30, 32 at the back, and you can pretty much get up a brick wall with no level of fitness, can't you? But back then, what were you using back then?
My normal setup would have been 42, 52, and 12, 21 on the back for a normal kind of slightly hilly stage.
Yeah.
And if into the mountains, I would change the inner ring to 41.
Just one tooth. I was thinking you were going to say 38 or at least 39. Bloody hell.
No, right. I would change just one. The thing about having a 41 chain ring is it made you feel special because they were only available to certain people from the Campagnolo truck, which used to go to the Worlds.
Yeah.
I don't know when you went to the Worlds, if you rode Campagnolo as an amateur, they would come and make sure that, and you were going to be in kind of in the front or whatever, they would come and make sure that all your Campagnolo equipment was presentable.
Yeah.
And so when I turned pro, I asked them for, I heard that there was the Mythic 41 inner chain ring that fitted on.
Brilliant.
So I asked for one. And because I used to do quite well at the Worlds, they gave me one. So I always kept that. So when I was on a Campag team, then I would have a 41 chain ring for the mountains. So basically at the Giro, I would take my 41 chain ring along and give it to the mechanic and get it back afterwards. Otherwise it'd just be lost in the system.
Bloody hell. That's an amazing little story that you used to carry around your own little 41 ring that you owned. That's fantastic.
That was mine. So I think I've still got it. Yeah, I probably will. I wouldn't have given that away. It was only certain people got them. Because when you thought back to how that Campag setup, the smallest it was sold to the public was a 42, because that was apparently the smallest that you could get on the Spider.
Yeah.
So having a 41 ring was quite good. And anyway, going back to the gearing, I would probably go to 41, 22 or 23. 23 sure. would be the maximum. The only time I would use something like 25 would be if it was really, really steep at the top of a major mountain.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I was kind of racing towards in your pomp in the mid kind of 80s, early kind of 90s, I was just getting into racing and obviously I was using similar kind of gearing. And you're quite right. Even if you had a 23 on, which was pretty much the lowest I can remember using, or maybe even a 24, say on a really hilly stage, the Milk Race, Devil's Staircase or something like that. For most of the day, even if you knew you had it, you wouldn't use it because you'd psychologically want it in reserve. So most of the time it used to be overgeared. And also because the gearing back then, it was, again, if you had like top end Campag or Shimano, it was still nice. But quite often, if you actually put it onto the largest plate on the back, the rear met used to sometimes rub the spokes, didn't it?
Because it bent. Then it would tinkle the spokes. And
that's it.
If you put too much pressure through the pedals, you thought you're going to rip the gear off or stick it in the or destroy the wheel. So you used to save the last sprocket for the emergency part.
Exactly. It was like a break glass in emergency gear, really, wasn't it? And you'd hardly touch it, even though.
And that happened to me when I at Lombardy one time, where you had to go up this climb, you needed 25.
Yeah.
And we were getting near the top, and I was still in the kind of front group, and it was getting harder and harder. And I started to use the 25 before I got to the steep part.
Right.
So just before the final corner, the final switch back onto where it got really, really steep, I changed back to 23. So when I changed back to 25 coming out of the corner, it felt smaller. And even then I had to stand up because it was so steep that I just made it up there and no more.
Oh, is that the climb is it the Muro?
No, it's not the Muro, because the Muro was only short, and you could get up that on 23. I think that one that they call the Muro has always been in there. It's always quite about 20K from the finish, 25K.
Yeah.
And normally if you're in the front group, then it doesn't – the decision is made then.
Sure.
It's already made, so there's probably between 5 and 10 riders in the front, and it's only if you're somebody's really strong that they'll go from there to the finish.
It's just amazing. You're quite right. I mean, looking at old videos of riders in the mountains, even going back then even further back from your time, you go back into the 70s and the 60s, it does look like, I mean, the whole aspect of pedaling dynamics has changed, because it looked like riders were quite often just doing weight training on the bikes, doesn't it? A lot of the backs, you know, just the style on the bike is completely different than it is now. I wouldn't say it's a difference.
It's not a different sport, but you had to fight the bike a lot more because you're basically overgeared. Although at the time you were thinking you weren't overgeared because that's all you had to play with. You couldn't ask for a 27 or a 29 because it didn't exist.
Yeah.
And 39 didn't exist before. So,
you didn't really, there was nothing, the thing is, you didn't worry about it because you still had a pretty low gear on for what was available. So as long as you had pretty much nearest what was available, then you were fine, weren't you? That's just the way it was. If it was a steep hill, you're going to go, you know, it's going to be a very, very low cadence. There was no real thinking, oh no, I need a lower gear. It just didn't compute really then, did it?
Well, there was it's a different kind of thing. Once you got to something really steep, there was no acceleration possible. So then it was just a case of keeping the same cadence and the kind of not slowing down too much, because then you got to stalling speed. What I used to call it, whereas you couldn't turn it over anymore, then you had to get your feet out quick because you were going to fall over. So you had stuff like the Koppenberg where people fell over just because they got to what I called stalling speed. And it's a bit like flying an aircraft with it. You know, you weren't going forward anymore, so you went sideways.
Yeah, that's it. It's just a matter of reaching that tipping point in terms of physics, really, isn't it? Especially on a climb like that. Did you ever ride many of the cobble classics back then? I know you loved riding in the Ardennes, and Liège was a race that you really enjoyed and did exceptionally well in. But did you ever ride any? Did you ever ride Flanders and those sorts of events? You did, right? How did you find them?
I got sent there, so I got sent to the early March classics as a first year pro, because basically the French guys in the French team didn't want to go to Belgium.
Yeah. Okay. So this is with Peugeot, isn't it?
So this is with Peugeot. So I learned that I got sent there because they didn't want to go.
Okay. That sounds fair. Typical French team. Yeah.
So I got a baptism. So I'd never raced in Belgium.
Wow.
As an amateur.
So that's amazing.
So my first race in Belgium was Het Volk.
Yeah.
What is it they call it now? They don't call
it Het Volk now, isn't it?
Newsblad. So I got sent there, and my job was to get in the break.
Okay.
So we had there was about six of us, and it was all four. We were all the foreigners from Peugeot. There was at Het Volk. I don't think there was any French guys there. So my job, because I was gullible enough to take on that challenge, was to get in the break.
Okay.
So when it set off in typical Belgian classic style, 50k an hour down the main road, 60k an hour now and again, I got in the break. I managed to get in the break. my kind of first cases of going to the Belgian classics were quite different to what they would have been if they'd been in the bunch, because I was in the break. So when you got to the cobbles, there was only about 10 or 15 of us, and then I just hung on until I got dropped.
Sure.
So I got sent to Het Volk, and because I'd done so well at Het Volk by getting in the break, here's the logic of the team. they sent me to Tour of Flanders.
As you would a climber, yeah.
as you would a first-year pro, and I got in the break there as well, because my job was to get in the break. But there was a couple... So I got in the break at Tour of Flanders, and we got to the cobbles, and I went up Koppenberg in the front group, but got dropped near the top. And then because I had done so well at Tour of Flanders, I then got sent to Gent-Wevelgem.
Oh my God!
To be baptized in riding in the side wind at 60k an hour and jumping over railway lines. Or tram lines as you get when you get to Japan, and I got in the break there as well.
Flipping heck.
But the break in Gent-Wevelgem, there was about 25-30 of us in the break. So when you came back in the echelon, At first, I didn't want to go through because I couldn't, because I was there with all those big Belgian Kermes riders, and they were killing me. And then I thought, I'm just going to sit on. But when you sat on, because the road wasn't wide enough for 25, 30 riders, you were in the gutter.
Yeah.
So I was hanging on before I even got to the side wind at Depana. So then I started to go through because I thought, well, it's better to go through. But when we got to the side wind, our group split into two, and then the race came with all the animals. So Moser, Jan Raas, Knetterman, the whole rally squad came.
Yeah.
Going three times as fast as we were, so I didn't even get on the wheels. And it went like that through the different kind of echelons, which were going towards the front, and I was going backwards. And I think we got to about the third or fourth echelon, and I saw my first teammate.
Who was it? Was it like, was it Piper or Phil Anderson or Yatesy?
It was, if I remember rightly, it was Roger Leger, who went on to become Director Sportif. And he was in the fourth echelon, and that meant he was probably 80th position.
Right.
And I only saw him for about, I don't know, 10 seconds. So then we turned off this. So the side wind only, again, when you go along the coast at Depana, and the tram lines and all the classic bit where you see everybody falling off and it's complete mayhem, that only lasts about 10, 15 kilometers before you turn off and you go into the hills. So, but when you turned off and went into the hills, I was already back in the kind of laughing groups, and it were just gone to the feet. And that's where most of the Peugeot team was. They were in the kind of 100th, 120th position. So we just rode to the feet and then we stopped. But you still had to do Kemmelberg. I think we did Kemmelberg twice.
Right.
So you do it from different directions. And because I'd never been there, I didn't have a clue what was happening. And then after Kemmelberg, it was the feed, and I think we didn't ride. I don't remember if we rode to the finish for the training or not, because the team car said we were crap and we had to ride to the finish. Because sometimes at the classics, if you didn't do well enough, the team car would go straight past you until you ride to the finish because you weren't kind of strong enough. So they would take it as kind of training, even though you were broken. You know, the race had broken you, so. So I did. I've done all the classics. The only classic I haven't done is Paris-Roubaix. Oh, the other ones, I've done them.
Right, and they're all in your first year. I mean, I honestly didn't realise that you had no experience of riding in Belgium, because nowadays, and probably for the last 20 or 30 years, even more, you know, most young riders get kind of bloodied, as it were, for want of a better phrase, over in Belgium to learn your kind of trade. And that's really interesting that you just got plunged straight in at the deep end. And riding on that sort of train. So you had to really learn on your feet, didn't you, straight away?
Well, I didn't have a clue what was going to happen. So it's,
God, that's amazing.
And the next year, after my first year as a pro, it's the second year as a pro, because I'd done so well at the classics, they sent me back to the same ones.
God.
So I got sent back to Het Volk and Gent Wevelgem and Tour of Flanders is the second year. And it's only in my third year that I didn't have to go there.
Yeah.
Because I crogged up the pecking order, and they some new pros had arrived and they sent them instead.
Because this would have been 1980, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It was your first year as a pro, wasn't it? Because 79, you won the British Amateur Road Championships and turned pro. And you were... You were in ACBB, because I rode for ACBB as well. And what years were you in ACBB? Was it 78, 79?
So I was on there for 78. I did 1 year. So basically ACBB used to take a set of foreign riders, and hopefully a couple of you would turn pro.
Yeah.
So I was good enough to turn pro after 1 year, but some riders were there a bit longer.
Yeah.
But I only did 1 year. And the interesting thing about ACBB is even they didn't go to Belgium. You only went to the north of France, but you didn't go into Belgium.
Sure.
So even at that amateur level, they were quite scared of going to Belgium and racing, because there was this mythic thing about the Belgians would eat you.
Jesus, it's so funny, isn't it?
And even when you went to the north of France, it was like going to a fork in a foreign country where the people were more aggressive and they were stronger and harder and all the rest of it. There was this kind of mythic thing about going up north, and people were harder than they were down at Paris. even though it was what, 150 miles away, or something like that.
It's not that far.
We don't go up north. There's people there. They're hard up there. They go and race in Belgium, that kind of thing.
So it's almost like the French version of the north, a little bit of the north-south divide, soft southerners and tough northerners, yeah, kind of thing going on, isn't it?
It was that. Well, we don't go there. It's too hard up there. They go to Belgium. I thought, what? What's that about? It's not north up there. Belgium is not north from Scotland.
You clearly look back on your time as a pro rider with a lot of fondness. And I know when we've talked before at a few times, I can see the look in your eyes, and you light up when you talk about the old days. Although, I guess there, you were going through your own kind of personal struggle, but it's quite clear to me that you relaying these stories, there's still a great deal of fondness about your time as a pro. I mean, am I right in saying that?
Yeah, they were great. You have so much fun racing, even though it hurts. Basically, you enjoy it. It's this kind of it's a kind of strange thing that you think, oh, this is really hard. Isn't it great?
let's be honest. Pro bike riders have to be a little bit sick in the head, a little bit. You have to be a little bit of a sadist, don't you? Because you're constantly hurting yourself.
You can spend all day in a line out in the gutter behind the same person, and it eases up just a fraction, and you've enjoyed it. You've actually thought, wow, that was great. Look how fast we were going. Even though it wasn't you that was making you go that fast and you didn't really want to hurt yourself that much.
Yeah.
You think about it and you think, wow, that was great, wasn't it?
You get a bit of a buzz. You definitely get an endorphin drop, don't you? You know, even when you've suffered.
There's something wrong with you that you thought that was good fun. But basically it was, because you went so fast that there was, there's some kind of adrenaline thing to it. And you think, oh, wow, this is great. What else could I be doing that's this much fun? I mean, the only time it's not fun is when you're freezing cold and it starts snowing or it's raining or you fall off.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think we've all had times when you're riding along and you do then start to question your choice of profession, don't you? I mean, I've had a few moments. I mean, my career was nowhere near as illustrious and as long as yours, but still you often think, what on earth am I doing here? I mean, generally, when you were suffering, but cold, I think it's that's when I've kind of thought about my life choices, when I can almost start to feel the shape of my internal organs because it's so cold. You've got this kind of, you're aware of a warm mass as the center of your body, but I've been so cold on a few occasions where I can actually start to feel my internal organs, and that's actually quite terrifying. It's the only way I can describe it.
Have you ever got so cold that your fingers, you think you've got frostbite?
Yes, in the Giro once. I started to cry. I cried.
Were your fingers still hurting a couple of days later?
Yes, they were tingling. The tips of them stayed white. And then I didn't have frostbite, but I don't know. But they stayed white for a couple. It was horrible. I take it you've clearly had an experience like that.
Yeah, I've had that. And the funny thing about when it happened to me is, we were at the Pays Vasco, the Basque Country race.
Oh, right. You wouldn't write. Okay.
So early April, in between Criterium of Dauphine. What was it? Criterium de Dauphine. What was it called? Criterium International. What do they call it now?
It's still Criterium International. What was it called now? Just a little two or three day race, wasn't it?
And then there's the classics. And we used to go, guys would do the first classics, and then they would do Pay Basque, and we went there. I was at Panasonic, and they said the weather was going to be variable.
Okay, that's very ambiguous, isn't it?
which for Pay Basque means it could be anything or it could be everything, and it was everything. Yeah. So the first day we set off, and do you remember those big one piece suits you used to get for training in the winter? That kind of thin rubé material, thermal material. So I had a long sleeve jersey on top of that, the one piece suit.
Wow.
Boots, gloves, everything. It was freezing cold, but it wasn't raining.
Right.
Then it started raining, and then it started kind of hailstoning.
Okay.
And then the sun came out. And when the sun comes out in April in that part of Spain, it goes to 15, 20 degrees.
Yeah, it's quite warm straight away, yeah.
So off came the long sleeve jersey, the gloves, the boots, the whole thing. And everybody, and I couldn't take the one piece suit off because basically I was in it for the day. My number was on it.
Okay.
So I was sweating buckets. But all the other people around about me hadn't been so stupid enough to start in the one piece suit.
Right.
And so they ended up in short sleeves and shorts, no gloves. And there was two mountains left to go over in this stage. So I was hanging on, sweating. And the sun came out on the even stronger on this hill. So we were all sweating a bit and everybody was sweating. And then we got to the top and it started snowing. So we went down the other side in the snow towards the next hill.
And there was no, if people are listening in, there was no bad weather protocol back then. I mean, whatever the conditions, pretty much you rode in, didn't you? Whatever the weather threw at you.
So because there was guys everywhere, the team cars couldn't get up to the front. So we went down the other side in the snow and hit the next hill, and it started hailstoning and snowing in the center. Kind of, I don't know how it happened, but hailstones at the bottom and snowing at the top. And when we got to the top, you were riding in track. So you could see tire tracks on the road. And I was kind of okay then because I was in the one-piece suit, but my hands and my feet were frozen.
Right.
And my head was frozen because you didn't have a helmet. You had those normal. And I'd thrown you had a, what you call a rain casket, so it was kind of plastified.
Okay.
So that was waterproof. But I'd thrown that away because I was too hot. So I only had a cloth hat, the normal casket.
Yeah.
So that was soaking, so there was snow in the front of that. But all round about me, there was people crying because they were in short sleeves and shorts and no hat.
God almighty.
And when we got to the finish, my hands were so cold that 3 days later, do you remember capsuline, that stuff that you used to get to put on your legs?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
That you couldn't put on much of it because it burned you.
Yeah, yeah. So you're going to tell me you put that on your hands?
I put that on my hands the next day because my hands were so sore and still cold. And I was in the one-piece suit again because I didn't dare be that cold again. And people were crying at the finish. They were so cold. And at that tour of the Basque Country, I rode every day in the one-piece suit and I managed to finish in the front group. And the only day I got dropped was the day my one-piece suit hadn't dried out on the radiator in the hotel and I had to wear normal clothes.
Flipping heck.
So I had to wear kind of normal leg warmers and arm warmers and jerseys. And that was the only day I got dropped because I got so cold. And every day it snowed, rained, hailstones. Sunshine. Yeah. It was great.
Bloody
and that's where I discovered that how to get frostbite on a push bike.
I mean, that's that little point at the end there when you talk about, you know, I know you still got looked after as a pro in terms of kit, but you didn't have the same variety and you generally didn't, and unless you're in a big hotel and they used to collect the bags of washing, you used to pretty much wash your own kit in the sink or in the shower, didn't you, in the bath. And then dry it on the radiators. And if certain things like your shoes weren't dry, I mean, I don't know, it was just different. Yeah, you just put wet shoes on, didn't you?
You just put wet shoes on.
Yeah.
After a while, they started having proper hair dryers in the hotels.
Yeah.
So you could jam the hair dryer from in the bathroom in your shoes and they'd be dry while you went for your dinner.
There's a slight risk they might burn the hotel down, but it's better than having cold feet the following day, mate, isn't it?
You know, if the hotel burnt down, you wouldn't start the race because all your stuff was burned, so you could go home.
God, no, that's incredible. Just one quick story from me about drying your shoes. I don't think I've talked about it on the podcast. It was the Giro di Regione, 1991, I think, and it was wet weather. And I was sharing a little apartment with a guy called Matt Possel from Wales, lovely Welsh lad. And we're riding for GB. Anyway, it was pouring down the rain and we were absolutely soaked cold. And he decided to put his time shoes in the oven. So he didn't tell me. He basically put his shoes in the oven, just straight in, turn the oven on. And I could smell. And he put them on a baking tray. And I could smell this. I was just in the apartment after dinner, smell this burning. I thought, Matt, what's that burning? And he says, oh, no, it's my shoes. So he ran to the oven and got some oven gloves and took out his time shoes. And they were on fire, the straps. And he only had one pair of shoes. So we managed to get we threw his shoes in the sink and poured water over them and got them dry, but they'd all melted. Anyway, but he had to wear them, and so the Velcro had perished and burnt. But for the next 3 days of the race,
toe straps.
He used to put his shoes on. Yeah, well, toe straps and electrical tape that you used to do your bars up with. So the mechanic would just gaffer tape his shoes up. And people, we could just took the piss out of him forevermore after that. But yeah, note to self, don't put your shoes in the oven.
Nowadays, don't put them in the microwave.
Oh yeah, don't. Yeah, there's bits of metal in there. And so have you? Don't tell me you've done that. Don't tell me you've done that. No. But I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to just break for a moment, Pip, if you don't mind. And I don't know if you've listened to any of the podcasts before, but there's a segment of this podcast called Guess That Snack, okay, where I ask my guest to guess the snack that I'm eating, okay? I tell you what the snacks are first, okay? So there'll be a variety of snacks, which I'll go through in a few moments' time. And then just by the sound of the crunch, I'd like you to work out what that snack is, okay? So we're going to insert now a little jingle, which they'll do. So it's time.
Guess that snack, guess that snack. Oh yeah, guess that snack.
First off, Pippa, what do you reckon to the jingle?
I thought I was on Radio 1 in the 1980s.
There you go. That's Cecile Utrop-Ludwig, you know. She did that especially for us. But anyway, so we're in Guess That Snack now. Complete break off from what we're talking about, but it just gives us a bit of time to... Well, it gives me an opportunity to get something to eat, to be honest with you. So I've got four snacks. We normally do three, but I'm going to up the ante a little bit on this edition of Matt Stevens Unplugged, Pippa. We're going to go for four snacks. I'm hoping that you've heard of all of them. I've no doubt you will. I have some mini pretzels, okay?
I don't eat them.
You don't eat those, but you'd imagine I know what the sound's like. I'd like to think you would. So mini pretzels, they are about the size of a 50 pence piece in the shape of a pretzel. They are actual mini pretzels. I also have Walker's Square Crisps. Do you remember these?
Vaguely.
So they're very anemic looking. Square crisps, and I've got salt and vinegar flavour. They've just opened the bag, and there's a real pungency that's just hit me right in the face. So square crisps, Frazzles.
What are they?
You don't know what a Frazzle is?
No.
They are a corn-based snack, but they look like...
they're vegan crisps. Frazzle. Yeah,
there you go. Oh, you just got great. So Frazzles, they look like bits of bacon. They're small. They're so tasty. I'll send you a bag, or just buy a bag yourself, because you go to Poundland, which I go quite a lot, 8 bags for a pound. I mean, you can't say fairer than that, can you? Then finally, Wotsits.
Yeah, I know what Wotsits are.
You know what Wotsits are, don't you? So I've got four snacks. So Wotsits, Frazzles, Square Crisps, and those mini things that I've forgotten the name of.
Pretzels.
Pretzels, thank you very much. So God almighty.
Pretzels, Frazzles, Square Crisps, and what was the last one?
Wotsits.
Wotsits, okay.
So I'm going to start off now. So I'm putting the first one in. Pippa, it's time
to guess that snack.
here we go. What do you think that was?
I'd say that was the square crisps.
Oh, it was a pretzel. It was a pretzel. Oh.
I don't eat pretzels, so I don't. It was a guess.
It's a good guess. But let's move on to snack number two. Just putting it in my mouth now. Here we go. Listen closely. Concentrate.
Oh, that's a what's it?
Straight off the bat, straight in. Well done. So you got one out of two. Next up, here we go. Here we go. So
that sounds like a looking at the picture of a Frazzle, which I'm not familiar with, I would say that was. Oh wait a minute. So they're bacony. I wonder if they're bacony consistency as well. See, this is a dilemma between the crisp and the Frazzle.
I'm going to give you a hint. So your first line of thought was pretty much spot on.
So it did sound like they had looking at the images of Frazzles, they look like they've got a bit of air in them, which crisp wouldn't have. So crisp would be a more crunchiness. So I would say that was the vegan Frazzles.
Congratulations. Lee, 2 out of 3. And that's, I tell you what, I'm going to give you an extra bonus point for your methodology, your deduction there. But just, there you go, we've got the extra point in the bag. The fact you've never had a Frazzle but looked at the packet and the new science is astonishing. Well done. Last one, you obviously know what it is. This is a...
That'll be a Walker's Squares crisps. Walker's Square crisps.
Indeed.
I can't tell you what taste it was.
Salt and vinegar.
Oh, okay, the best one then. Vinegar.
So there we go. You actually got 4. Well, because you got the bonus point, you actually got 4 out of 4. That was Guess That Snack.
Guess that snack. Guess that snack. Oh, yeah, guess that snack.
There we go. Yeah, it's definitely worth buying some. I mean, I know I don't want this podcast to turn into a snacks advert, but they are sensational. I even sprinkle them in soup. So tomato soup, get some Frazzles, sprinkle them in. It will take you to basically paradise in your mouth.
I'll tell you about soup.
Go on then.
I've started putting an egg in my soup.
Have you? I don't know why that's funny. So you're just breaking an egg and the soup cooks it, does it?
Oh, no, it's either a fried egg or a poached egg. It goes in the soup.
Wow.
And apparently it's a Polish thing. But my other half isn't impressed. She says it's, I think to use her words, disgusting.
Well, I wouldn't call it disgusting. I'd call it interesting. But
I'm sure I've had it before on a bike race. I'm sure when the Giro went into Austria, we were given soup with an egg in it, although it was something like that consomme soup, so the egg was really apparent.
Right.
Whereas when you put it in tomato soup, it kind of sinks to the bottom and you can't see it. So it's one of those hidden surprises.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, it does sound like something the Austrians might do with an egg. I mean, I'm a big fan of Austria and that neck of the woods, but their cuisine's interesting, isn't it? It's a bit of an eye opener. Some quite abstract sort of styles of cookery that they do. Okay, well, Pippa, I want to talk a little bit about now and about the cycling industry. And obviously, you've been working within cycling for pretty much your entire life, and you've recently been doing some commentary. You compete as Robert Miller. We all know that you're now Philippa York. And I just wanted to ask you how you feel within the cycling industry at the moment. Do you feel that you've got a proper voice? Do you feel represented? Do you still feel it's hard to get work? I'm kind of just asking you really, really kind of plainly and honestly now. How do you kind of feel right now within the cycling industry?
It's something I've had to process. Returning in my present condition, state, persona.
Yeah.
Not sure what the quite whether correct word would be. I've had to kind of process how I feel about that, and certain things kind of are a bit challenging, or have been.
Yeah.
Do I think it brings me more or less work? Oh, I think that depends on the circumstances. If it's a basic kind of bike race reporting kind of commentary thing, I don't think it does. I think you're there a bit on your merits of what you know and what you can communicate or report.
Yeah.
For other things, for kind of more general cycling things, the way that the world is going with the whole kind of equality and discrimination stuff that young people will no longer put up with.
Yep.
It's probably an asset, because I come with kind of two stories to tell. One of the kind of elite athlete who functioned quite well.
Yep.
And then one is the kind of the person who comes with a diversity and equality story, and hopefully I can tell that quite well too. But I wouldn't say that it's an advantage, my kind of present condition. I think it's just one of those things that's happened, and I've tried to deal with it in the kind of same way that I dealt with my career.
Yeah.
So the kind of various steps and stuff, kind of went to a plan. But how do I feel about the how the cycling industry deals with me? I think some people are okay. There's certain companies which were quite progressive, and obviously they have kind of proper human resources departments and a kind of policies and stuff. And then there's others which kind of are catching up, and they sometimes don't use you as much as they can. So it's one of those ongoing things where people are. I think my case has put a lot of people in a kind of funny position that they not quite sure how to deal with me.
Yeah.
And so they either choose not to, or they feel quite awkward about it.
Yeah.
And I always say to people that I'm just a kind of a normal person who dealt with something which wasn't quite as normal as most people would have to deal with.
Sure.
And I used to say that about my bike riding as well. I'm just a bike rider. Yeah. And I got to a level which wasn't available to everybody, and most people wouldn't get to, but I still go to the shops and, you know, I still function as a basic human being, and I try to, you know, keep that saneness about my life instead of getting involved in too many kind of things which are demonstrations of the kind of, you know, I don't shout about my human rights or of discrimination or any stuff. I'll talk about it if people ask me about it.
So I was going to say, for you, and I know that you have talked about this a little bit before on TV and in some interviews, when you first officially, for want of a better word, announced to the world your transition, etc. But what I'm trying to say is how are you trying to affect kind of people's attitudes? Are you quite happy just to, is it more important for you to make sure that you live a normal life and protect your family, etc.? Or do you really want to affect kind of change, or are you kind of ambivalent to that? I mean, where do you kind of stand? Where do you think you potentially have a role in all that?
So looking at the platform that's available to me as people say in that kind of modern kind of management speak, the role that I can have is to affect how people see the whole kind of transition process and people who actually go through that or start along that kind of whole journey. And I can try and explain it as it happened to me, and I'm quite happy to talk about that. Not because I think it's something to promote, but the more knowledge that people have about what happens and if it's going to, how it's going to affect basically everybody, from the person who's transitioning to the whole kind of family unit or friends or whoever who's close to that person.
Yeah.
If I can give out that kind of information and that knowledge of how it may go, that may help those people. And I see that as kind of what I ought to talk about if people ask me about it, but I won't actively go and seek to kind of promote that, because I don't think that's the best way of communicating it.
Sure.
Because when you kind of, if you go and you shout about you want this and you want that and you want it yesterday, people tend to shut down. But if people are curious and they want to ask you a question, I'm in most cases I'm quite happy to answer that.
Yeah.
And I think that given the kind of access I have to certain media platforms, I ought to talk about it if asked.
Yeah.
Just so that information is put out there, and it is, we're not getting information just from the people who are kind of saying that gay people and trans people and bisexuals are whatever kind of condition or thing you're going through, they should be kind of kept quiet and nobody should talk about it, because it encourages young people to kind of follow that. And when it really isn't that at all.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's worth touching on another kind of, I wouldn't call it a thorny subject, but it's one that's intrigued me and many, many observers for a long time, I guess, although it's hardly ever spoken about. And you obviously struggle with your own identity all through your professional career, and I know, to quote you, you said that you somehow managed to compartmentalize that and still managed to be an exceptionally successful, the finest, you know, proponents of road cycling of your generation and one of the best British riders of all time, yet you essentially were somebody else at the same time, and you managed, and you kind of managed that. But what are your thoughts on, and when you look at sexuality, and not just people, you know, who feel their like gender identity, but in terms of actual sexuality, what do you think about, you know, 1,000 registered professional male road cyclists and not one being outwardly gay or openly kind of gay? And do you think, because statistically that's, you know, basically an impossibility.
It's
still a remarkably macho sport, and the word macho I find increasingly more distasteful, but I think people are becoming, you know, more comfortable about expressing themselves, you know, talking about other things apart from, you know, going hard on a bike, although I still love to talk about the stories that you know, with old professionals. But what do you think about that? Do you think it's still suppressed, isn't it? Massively suppressed because of attitudes of sponsors, perhaps people within teams, organisations are kind of afraid to have an openly gay bike rider.
This is what I call the gay footballer syndrome. This when you look at football or any kind of a male kind of dominated sport where it's basically just males who watch other males competing or playing or whatever it is. And there's nobody in those big kind of what you call macho sports is openly gay, and it's a statistic. It's mathematically impossible because it's somewhere, what is it? Somewhere between 6 and 10% of the population has some kind of gay feelings or tendencies. Yeah. So when you go to something like Tour de France and there's 200 riders on the start line, basically it's 12 of them are gay or somewhere on that spectrum.
Yeah,
I like to call it the gay spectrum because then you don't have to say the whole LGBT plus IQ thing. So somewhere on that gay spectrum, there's 12 of them who kind of have that sexuality or tendencies or whatever you want to call it. So, but none of them feel comfortable enough in the sport to be open about it.
Yeah.
But this is the 21st century.
I know.
And the companies and the sponsors that they work that they're representing don't have those policies in place which would discriminate against them.
Yeah.
So they have the backing of the sponsor, but they don't feel comfortable enough amongst their colleagues or amongst the people that they're working for, basically the team setups, to be open about it. And I find that really disappointing. Not for the person, but for the structure of the sport. And it's not just a cycling thing. There's so many kind of male-dominated sports which have those same kind of inbred feelings that you can't really. It's okay if you're straight and you're white and you kind of fit that whole kind of strong kind of I wish I could be like you kind of thing. But
yeah,
for anybody who's even slightly on that gay spectrum, they don't talk about it because it's and you get the feeling it's judged as a weakness, as a physical or mental kind of slight of your character or who you are, which is crazy because sport is the entertainment industry, and if there's one industry which is going to have a whole set of gay people, it's the entertainment industry, because when you watch television or films or anything, there's no problem. They have no problem at all with that whole diversity thing, but sport seems to, and I find that really disappointing.
Yeah, it is. It is strange, and I think it is primarily male-dominated sports as well, like you say. Although I think there's far, as far as I'm aware, there's far more openness in relation to, you know, females being gay. You know, there's a lot more openness in cycling in relation to gay females. There's clearly no issue with that. But when it comes down to being, and there shouldn't be, and there isn't. But when it comes down to being a bloke in a cycling team, it seems there clearly is so much pressure on individuals not to, to just conform to the old stereotype, even in the 21st century. But can you imagine being, you know, out of the thousand, this figure I put out, yeah, there's more than 1,000 pros, but can you imagine being, let's even be conservative and say there's only 25, and the list super conservative. Can you imagine the pressure that those individuals are under day in, day out, because they can't express who they really are? I mean, I don't know, it's awful, isn't it?
I don't think it's even the question of promoting your own sexuality. I think it's that person having to pretend. Yeah. You know, so the whole banter that goes on in cycling teams, you know, there's a lot of kind of sexual banter goes on, because obviously you're away from home and you see people you're attracted to in various situations, and
yeah.
people and young men discuss that kind of stuff. Even old men discuss that stuff.
Yeah.
And those individuals, you have to kind of join in. Otherwise, you'll be seen as this is kind of something wrong with you.
Yeah,
you're weak, or you don't fit into that kind of whole team structure. So that must be really difficult. And like you say, for the female side of things, they don't really have a problem with it. And I do wonder if that's because there's this whole kind of males in the shower kind of thing, or are they looking at me? What's wrong with them kind of stuff? I wonder if it's that.
Yeah, it's funny, but it's so old school, isn't it? It's so, you'd have thought, because of how progressive they still, I mean, look at the situation that the world's in now over the awful death of George Floyd, and minorities being you know proportionately represented, etc. And you'd think that something like gay men in cycling, for example, would be something that years ago we would have dealt with and had accepted and that we had no kind of issue with. But clearly, I think it's just the unspoken issue, isn't it? Because nobody's outwardly saying there shouldn't be any pro cyclists, male cyclists that are gay. It's completely and utterly unspoken, isn't it? But there's clearly this pressure, this environment that's maybe a little bit toxic still, that suppresses these people. So we don't actually know who they are unless they're, and I'm sure they're not happy in kind of keeping that kind of thing to themselves, because they're having to live these double lives, aren't they?
because even afterwards, people don't talk about it. Yeah. You know, so even afterwards, when you get riders who've obviously retired, even if they were gay, they're not going to turn up with their partner at a bike race. It just doesn't happen, and you wonder why that is. You wonder why that whole kind of setup and that whole team structure doesn't allow people to be open, as if, because they would be open if they were working in any other kind of setup, you know. Yeah. So any other kind of company or anything. It's strange.
It is very strange. I mean, and I think I'd love to be able to talk a little bit longer about it. We're kind of coming to a bit of a close, but I think just to keep on that kind of point, I know that you've recently been an adopter to Zwift, and it's Pride Month, isn't it? Pride Month
it is.
At the moment.
That's why I'm there. 30th,
yeah. So just talk a little bit about what you're going to be doing with Zwift at Pride Month.
And how
people can maybe join you on a bike ride on Zwift.
So normally this is Pride Month, so I probably go on maybe two Pride events, local ones or a kind of bigger one if I went to Bournemouth or something like that. But they're not having them. So Zwift have realised that, you know, there's gay people out there. There's people who support gay people, and they're doing Pride On events, where a group of people sign up as kind of allies to the whole kind of gay movement, and you go for a gentle or not so gentle bike ride at a certain time. So they're on Tuesdays and Saturdays, and you sign up and you start and you ride whatever speed you want to. And looking at the classification of it, it said between 1.5 and 2 watts per kilo. So I thought at first, okay, this won't be too bad. I can ride at 2 watts per kilo.
Still pretty brisk, isn't it?
I'm okay at that. I'm sweating, but I'm okay. But I've discovered that not everybody wants to ride at that level. So, yeah. So the first one was a bit of a shock. So we set off and I didn't. So I set off quite kind of slowly and in the middle of the group. I think there was something like 600 or 700 people.
Wow,
which is quite strange when you—I've been really discovering, cool, discovering Swift, and it was kind of on your own, and people would catch you and or you'd catch them and they'd kind of follow you for a bit. So the whole kind of group dynamic of it was a bit strange at first. So then I had to speed up and I thought, I'll go and see what's happening at the front. But the front was so far in front that I never saw the front. Because they set off, I don't know, 4 or 5 watts per kilo straight away. And once you're a minute behind, or 2 minutes behind, you're never going to catch up unless you can ride like a pro. So I thought, well, stuff that. But that so now I've discovered that if you set off in the front line and you set off straight away, then somebody attacks, and then on the little screen, so then they start riding, and I can ride probably just behind the front group. But sure, it is hard. Sure, okay. You know, I have to ride quite hard. I think I'm at 3.5 watts per kilo or something, which is...
That's uncomfortable.
So that's, uncomfortable. So I'm really sweating then. So then it hurts. But the whole Zwift thing, it's quite strange how it changes your kind of pedal stroke and how you apply power. It's a very different thing to how I would ride outside. And I was speaking to Wayne Bennington, who I used to be a pro on Zed with. He was telling me how it's changed how he rides on climbs and stuff, because he lives in the south of France now. So he rides those big climbs that they do in the Pyrenees and those kind of climbs. So he was saying that it improved that. And I noticed when I went out the other day on the road that if I sit down, it kind of changes the whole dynamic of how I ride that climb. Looking at it and how I would use that as if I was still competing, I think I'd probably concentrate my time trial training on that kind of digital platform like Zwift.
It's interesting. It's an interesting platform, and like I say, it's, you know, that there are many comparisons to running on the road, but I think it's its own thing as well. And I know a lot of pros, Alex Dowsett for one, who's obviously his trade is performing well in it's being a time trialist. He does a lot of time trial training on Zwift now.
Because it changes the pedaling dynamic of the whole pedal stroke. So you tend to not only just press on the pedal, but tend to pull it up as well.
Yeah. So yeah, it's very, very interesting.
So there's a different strain on your ligaments and knees and things and your shoes and that kind of thing. So and that took a bit of getting used to, but I can see how that would be useful in for somebody like Alex to keep on top of his time trial training.
I mean, we are going to have to wrap things up, Pipple. I think we're going to have to do this again. We'll have to do part two because it's been fascinating. We've only just kind of scratched the surface of what we could talk about. I could literally sit here all day and talk to you quite happily and go and get some more snacks for you to guess, etc. Maybe get a brew on. But my one little parting question I'd like to ask. I don't know how much TV you watch, but obviously during these lockdown times, people have been searching for entertainment as best they can, whether it's podcasts, whether it's kind of new music or things on TV. Are you a particularly avid watcher of or consumer of content on telly? And if so, is there a particular drama or TV show that you would recommend to people listening to this podcast?
What have I been watching? So I've been watching Killing Eve.
Oh yeah, okay.
So I've watched all the series of Killing Eve again, up until the last one. So the last one was yesterday, so that was great. Okay. Even though people are arguing about the third series being not as good as the last one. But other than that, I'll probably watch Game of Thrones again from the start.
Well, I've never seen it. I chatted to somebody else about this last week. I'm on Breaking Bad. I'm still on like season, it's kind of, I'm on season 4 now.
I've never watched that.
It's great, honestly. It's so good. It's old now. It's 2008 it was made. But it's brilliant. It's just a wonderful character study of rather than, it's almost like the drug stuff in the background is just a kind of minor subplot to this kind of guy going through these. It's just great. I'd heartily recommend it. So you've seen Game of Thrones once already?
I've seen Game of Thrones. I think I've watched the complete series twice already, and I'll probably go back and watch it again.
Flipping heck, well, that's a good recommendation. I shall definitely do that.
And I like the surprises it has.
You like the surprises. Well, I've managed to keep clear of any spoilers. I think I've barred one or two over the last few years. So I shall embark on that, I think, once I've watched Breaking Bad. So, thank you very much indeed, Pippa. Great work on Guess That Snack, considering you hadn't eaten one of the snacks. I generally go through snacks that people have experienced before. But it's been a pleasure to talk to you, as ever. Hopefully we can do this again in the near future, because it was a lot of fun.
Okay, thank you very much.
We're firmly in the middle of June now as we record this, and while June is usually a fallow month in terms of Grand Tour action, I think there's room to have some Grand Chore fun. Last week, Stage 3 was emptying the dishwasher, throwing up some memorable action, and today's stage promises to be equally unpredictable. This is the Grand Chores Stage 4, making the bed. Welcome to Stage 4 of the Grand Chores, making the bed. Well, I'm in the bedroom. Sleep is finished. Sleep has now passed. Moving on to the making the bed part of the day. I'm going to talk you through a few little stats. It's good really to kind of map out what you're going to do when making the bed of a morning or of an afternoon if you've had a little bit of a lie-in. Well, we have got a super king-size bed, so it's big. Very, very big bed indeed. We've got a classic duvet. We've got four pillows atop and the bottom on each side. We've got a flowery design that was bought in John Lewis, but with a plain pillowcase underneath. We've got a mattress protector and a super king sheet on the top of the mattress protector, and it is a Therapure memory foam bed. So, I'm moving in straight away, stripping back the duvet cover. Now, a lot of people make the mistake of actually using too much energy too soon and going very, very deep, because what happens is through the night, the duvet gets moved around within the duvet cover. And if you're going to lift that up and kind of toss that out, that's going to spend a lot of energy. I'm going to do that a little bit later on, but I'm moving to the top end of the bed. Now, what's happened here, it's been quite a rough night's sleep, I think. So what I'm doing is re-tucking in the undersheet, so the padding, moving around the bed, making sure all four corners are done. Oh no! One of the pillows has fallen off in the night. That pillow is on the floor. That is going to cause a bit of a problem, having to reach down, pick it up. Oh! Bit of a twinge in the back. That's not what I planned for. That's going to cost us dear later on in the stage. But I'm back to making sure that the mattress protector is in place, moving the pillows to the side and then moving back in to the sheet. Now, back on top of the game now, back round the back of the bed, moving to the top corner, left-hand side of the bed, tucking in that sheet, using both hands, bending the knees as well. Important that you bend those knees, making sure it's nice and crisp, nice and tight, so the elastic on the sheet really clips underneath the duvet, snaps back. I often use a 50 pence piece or other coin just to bounce on the bed, just to make sure it's nice and tight. Smooth it down with your hands, ironing out any creases, using your body warmth as a sort of fleshy iron. Now, pillows are down. Now, give them a bit of a smooth out again, using your hands again. They need to be nice and crisp. Make sure those seams are aligned, because if you get the bed made and you spot that the seams are unaligned, you're going to have to start from scratch. Start the stage again, and that's the last thing you want. So both pillows are on, they're in place. Moving to the back of the bed, looking down the length of the bed towards the bed head, perfectly symmetrical. Okay, now, getting both hands either side of the back end of the duvet within the duvet cover, gripping onto both the inside of the duvet and the outside and giving it a big toss. Big, big toss, making sure that within the duvet cover, the duvet itself settled back into the position. And that is perfect, absolutely perfect. Smoothing things out yet again. Always checking for alignment, symmetry. Symmetry, absolutely key when making a bed. Any sort of bed, be it double, be it single, be it bunk, it doesn't matter. Smoothing things out, stepping back and taking a look. A perfectly made bed. Amazing stuff there, and all that hard work making the bed will definitely reap its rewards later in the stage day when I head to bed and find it in pristine condition. And it's a really big morale boost, isn't it? Getting into the bedroom, looking at the bed and seeing all neat and crisp to tuck yourself into.
Anyway, get in touch on Twitter at Real Stevens and at Sigma Sports if you have any grand chore suggestions using the hashtag grand chores. And don't forget, it's a great time to upgrade to ultimate performance with Ceramic Speed. Order an OSPW system at Sigma Sports throughout June and get a free, yes, a free Ceramic Speed UFO chain. So just head to sigmasports.com/podcast for all the details. Thanks again to Perry App Gwyneth for the musical jingles on the podcast, and thanks to you as ever for listening. Don't forget to like, subscribe and rate the pod, and why not recommend it to your cycling buddies or even your Amazon delivery person the next time they hang around your doorstep too long. And finally, I'd like to thank our magnificent guest today, Philippa York, for, well, basically what was a wonderful chat, and hopefully we can do it again very soon. What? Hold on a minute. Pippa, is that you? What on earth are you doing?
That's me struggling with a recalcitrant Allen key bolt on my 42 chain ring, which I want to get rid of for my famous, and now even more famous, 41 tooth Campag inner ring.
Oh, fair enough. Oh, cheers. Anyway, thanks.
This podcast is supported by Hot Chili. What's Hot Chili, I hear you ask? Good question. So let's ask the internet.
Hot Chili organises a variety of road and gravel cycling events in the UK and internationally, catering for riders of all abilities. Hot Chili has the cycling community at the heart of everything they do, and have a dedicated app for members to connect with each other.
Wow, sounds great. But of course, I did already know that. Visit hotchili.com or download the Hot Chili app and join the friendliest, funnest cycling community on the planet. Hot Chili is spelled H-O-T-C-H-I-L-L-E-E and .com is spelled full stop C-O-M.